You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of our weekly AL Central chat. I'm Anthony Castrovince. This is the Pod Castro. Thanks for tuning in. It was a huge week for the Chicago White Sox, who have turned terrific starting pitching into a terrific start. We'll talk with Scott Merkin about that. And we'll, of course, check in with the other beat writers from around the division to get the latest news and notes from around the Central. Let's get right to it. Merk, the White Sox are the first-place White Sox going into this week. Obviously, caught fire since we last spoke. The pitching's been good all year, but it's kind of been otherworldly here in this recent stretch. And not surprising in the case of Chris Sale and Jose Quintana. Those guys have been terrific.
Yeah, it's what they expected would drive them to the postseason. Now, again, you know, you temper everything by saying, you know, you're not even a month into the season at this point. So, you know, what's great now could be questionable in May or June. You never know. But it does. I've had a couple people come up to me, people I trust in baseball, who say this team looks legit. This team is impressive. They might be one bat short right now, but, you know, the Sox will go after that if that's the case. But the pitching is what drives them. And the key thing for the pitching, which goes hand in hand, is the defense has been outstanding this year. So, you know, last year, where sometimes Sox pitchers were kind of pressing to get the strikeout or had to get four or five outs in an inning, this year they're getting helped on, you know, excellent plays such as the triple play. I think it was 9-3-2, 6-2-5, if I remember, Friday night. But, yeah, Sale and Quintana is expected. Rodon has been good, minus one really bad start, and Leidos has been out of this world so far.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's an evolving personnel, as we're seeing this week. Now, we're recording this on Monday in advance of Miguel Gonzalez's White Sox debut, but certainly a big show of faith to call him up after signing him to that minor league deal earlier in the month. And you kind of juxtapose that against John Danks' struggles. So that dynamic, it remains to be seen how it all plays out, but certainly it seems like Miguel Gonzalez has the capability to stick in this rotation.
Well, it's interesting. This change came after John had a decent start, at least numbers-wise, I believe it was, Thursday, right, against the Angels. Six innings, two runs. Now, one thing that does not ever sit well with White Sox pitching coach Don Cooper, and pretty much any pitching coach or team in baseball, is that John walked five in that game. You know, and his velocity is kind of where it is at this point. You know, he's a different pitcher since the surgery. We've said that 1,000 times. But, you know, he did give them a chance to win in that game, and the offense just didn't come through against Jared Weaver that day. But, you know, there's a bunch of different interesting scenarios that come from this. You know, Miguel Gonzalez is going to get paid more than a nominal fee, obviously, when he, you know, makes his major league debut. So you would guess that he's probably there, whether it's long relief or spot start. So then what does that mean for John Danks? I had a chance to talk to John after the game Sunday, and, you know, he basically said that he was the emergency guy out of the pen on Sunday. So the one thing about John is you won't, as the old saying goes, you might find teammates that are as good as John, but none better than John. And if, you know, they want him to be long relief and pitch, you know, in mop-up duty, then he's going to do that. He's ready to do that. But as of right now, the plan was, as we tape this, the plan was Gonzalez to go in Toronto, followed by Sale and Quintana. Danks pitched the first game at Baltimore. And Robin's not big on going, you know, 2-3 weeks out past that. They're going to go with that and see what happens. I mean, I don't even think they have, you know, a Sunday starter set yet, which, you know, they have a couple different options, and possibly Gonzalez or Sale, which, you know, you'd most likely want to get Sale 2 starts on the road trip. But you see what happens. So, you know, they have options. That's who they're turning to, and he makes the most sense. I know Eric Johnson was up here as kind of insurance and didn't pitch. I think Gonzalez obviously is ahead of him now. Whether Gonzalez takes that dang spot or just is, you know, stretching out the staff this week, giving them an extra day, we shall see as the week plays on.
Well, one guy who certainly solidified his standing in this rotation in the early going is Matt Leitos. We've talked about him quite a bit already on this podcast in spring and after his first couple starts. But, man, he just keeps going. Merk, 4-0, started a White Sox career, probably already providing surplus value on that $3 million contract. Yet to allow a hit to a right-handed batter with his sinker, highest whiff percentage with his slider since 2013. I mean, this is some real stuff that's happening here.
He is to pitching excellence what the Eagles are to musical excellence pretty much right now, I think.
Oh, boy.
You know, pretty much unmatchable, unbeatable. No, and all, well, that is serious. But, you know, one thing I kind of have to laugh a little bit at is that, you know, in spring training, he pitched a lot in the minor league fields, which can be huge emphasis for him. You know what I'm saying? It can't be a huge adrenaline rush for him. This is a guy who's pitched in the majors for quite some time. And he even said that, you know, one of his things he likes to do is get inside on hitters, and he didn't want to really bust his own hitters inside when he's facing Avi Garcia on the backfield and, you know, possibly hit him there. But even in the two Cactus League games and in the exhibition game he pitched in San Diego, he wasn't great. He got hit a little bit. You know, his velocity wasn't great. And he told us, you know, with a smile on his face, that it takes one bullpen or even one pitch to get it going. And good Lord, I think he knew what he was talking about, because he's been very good. I mean, he's, you know, even against Texas, where he gave up 7 hits, and Texas was the highest scoring offense coming into U.S. Cellular Field this weekend in the American League. But, you know, he managed to get out of jams, and he's just done a great – and people forget, including myself, have forgotten that this was a really good pitcher before, you know, he got hurt. And the White Sox had a case like this in 2003, where Esteban Loaiza made it out of camp. He was a non-roster invite. He beat out Gil Heredia to be the fifth starter on that team and ended up as number two in the Cy Young voting that year behind Roy Halladay, won 21 games, had an ERA below 3, and started the All-Star game. So this is not unprecedented with the White Sox. They take a chance on a guy, and he pays big dividends. But, I mean, right now, you know, Leydos went from going into the season where we're kind of thinking, okay, who would be the next guy up if this continues, to, you know, along with Sale, to prime candidates for April Pitcher of the Month. He's been outstanding. You know, one final thing is, he said to me at one point during a group interview session, he said, you know, if he's healthy and can control that slider, he feels like he's a pretty good pitcher, and he's done both of those so far this year. He's been both of those so far this year.
He's been great. I don't know about the Eagles comp, though, Merck.
I think it works, man. If you let it marinate a little bit, I think it works.
As of now, I just look at it. Matt Latos is severely underpaid at the moment, whereas the Eagles were collecting gargantuan checks for their greatest hit tours, their farewell tours over the years. So I don't know about that comp. But
I mentioned briefly to you in the pre-talk here, with both Chicago teams looking to be pretty solid right now, Joe Walsh and Don Henley playing in Chicago this summer. So it could be a great summer in Chicago overall.
Zach, we talked last week about new addition, not about new addition, the pop group from the 80s, but about the new addition, Jordan Zimmermann, who's been quite good, of course, going into his Monday start. And Jared Saltalamacchia has also been excellent for the Tigers. But I want to talk about some things that aren't going as well on the new addition front. And Justin Upton certainly qualifies. He enters the week with a 214, 247, 314 slash. That is not good. Does not translate to good. What do you make of Upton's early struggles? Is this part of the streakiness that kind of comes with this player?
That's kind of how I looked at it the first couple of weeks. And I almost think we're getting beyond that now, to where, you know, I think when you get to 3 weeks, it's kind of beyond the streak, and it's legitimately a slow start here, and something is just not clicking. It does seem like he's putting a lot of pressure on himself. Yeah, I kind of think back to when Miguel Cabrera first came over in 08 and felt a lot of pressure that he wasn't accustomed to. I think batting in front of Cabrera hasn't had the impact that Tigers would have thought, not just because of Upton, but I think also because of the struggles of Cabrera. You know, I think going into the season, you saw that as a 2-3 combination where one could feed off the other. And really, it almost feels like their struggles are sinking each other kind of in tandem here. But I don't think he's doomed, but I think something here has got to start clicking here. You know, maybe it's time to consider lowering him down in the order, kind of see if that has any impact. Maybe it's time to kind of go to work with extra BP and see what's going on with the swings. Maybe it's time to start looking at scouting reports and seeing what opponents are doing here for a hitter who isn't accustomed to American League pitching, even though I think a lot of us would argue that the differences now are so blurred with guys going back and forth, it's where it shouldn't make that big of a difference.
Is a move out of the number two spot, as you mentioned, is that something Brad Ausmus has publicly given consideration to? Where does that thought sit right now?
He was pretty steadfast, like 5 days ago, that it wasn't going to happen. It would amount to a panic move. probably words he might regret now, because then a couple of days ago he got asked the question again, once the team returned home, and he didn't rule it out. He said they've talked about a lot of different things. The question would be, who do you put in that two spot to take his place? Is there a logical candidate? I know a lot of people raise Jose Iglesias as a possibility. He's off to a pretty good start at the plate. He's a good contact hitter. He's not a guy who's responded well to the two spot in the past. Yeah, it's a little different type of skill set than what he's had to show in batting lower in the order. But that said, if you're looking at a short-term move and just hoping to get up and going so you can move him back up there once he keeps up, then maybe it's something you approach a little bit differently. Anthony Gost is struggling. He'd be a candidate otherwise. I think center field is another position of flux for them right now while they wait and see what Cameron Maiden's health status is. And then you get beyond that, and you'd really be trying to put some square pegs in round holes, I think, beyond those two guys. So I think they're trying to avoid a large-scale reordering of the batting order, but there's not a whole lot of flexibility to where you can move too many other guys and still feel like you're comfortable with Victor cleanup in mid third.
Let's talk about K-Rod. Obviously, he's away from the team for a few days here on family medical emergency leave. But, you know, early on, he's had his struggles here, an ERA north of 7. I know he said he was embarrassed by his outing the other night. We talked earlier this season about the kind of extreme changeup usage. That seems to have come back down to earth. What do you make of his struggles to start the season?
Well, one thing about the Tigers' struggles over the last week is that they haven't had a lot of chances to use him. So I don't know if the lack of regular work has an impact at all. You know, once he comes back, he's going to go a stretch of close to a week, maybe more, where he hasn't pitched in a game. So it's going to be a test to get him back going, but potentially it could be an opportunity as well to kind of work on some things with his pitching, kind of look at the mechanics, see if there's maybe some situation where maybe there's a tipping in the pitches, although when you throw that many changeups, I don't really know if, you know, the element of surprise is that huge of a deal anymore. Is there something in the delivery that makes a difference? Is there something in the sequence? He's had, ironically enough, a pretty good breaking ball, it seems like, for much of these first few weeks. It hasn't really been a big pitch for him. It was a bigger pitch for him when he was younger, and he had that fastball to kind of complement it. Maybe that's something he goes back to as kind of a swing and miss pitch to try to get guys to chase. But, you know, that only works if you get ahead in the counts. And that's something that he was struggling to do in his recent save situations.
While we're on the new additions theme here, Mike Pelfrey. So he's 0-3, but he's got a solid 3.68 ERA. So, you know, just looking at that, you think, okay, he's been a little unlucky. But his fielding independent pitching mark is 6.23, and that's a better measure of what a pitcher has in his control. And that's obviously not an encouraging number. So it almost makes you think he has actually been lucky to have the ERA he has. I know it's only a few starts, but what's your read on Pelfrey's early contributions here?
Well, he's another guy who kind of went the route of saying it's been embarrassing and he's been terrible, and, you know, kind of a conventional type post-game session after his last start. The sinker's not sinking. The sinker's been flat. It's been kind of moving side to side as opposed to up and down. And they're trying to get that sink back in there. It got to the point where Brad Austin has caught his last bullpen session. I think it would have been on Saturday here in Detroit. So, and it wasn't necessarily a short bullpen session either. It was like 40 pitches, maybe a little bit more than that. He really went to work on trying to shore up those mechanics. I don't think work ethic's a problem with this guy. That said, I think for a 6'7" pitcher, when you get out of whack with your mechanics, I think it takes oftentimes to take some work for a guy like that to get them back in line and to get them consistent. But if you take away the sinker, he's a very vulnerable pitcher. This is a guy who's one of the main reasons Tigers got him is because of that sinker square combination. And when he has starts like last year in KC, where neither of them is moving with the intended spin, it creates problems. It creates line drives and extra base hits.
Rhett, last time we spoke, the Twins have gotten off the schneid as far as the season-opening losing streak is concerned, but the season-opening trend has still been rough for this club. Let's talk about something positive that's come out of that is Joe Mauer's performance. Now, we have all the caveats apply. He's 33 years old. It's April. But it's hard not to be enamored with what he's doing here early on. A 452 on base percentage entering the week, 15 walks against just 8 strikeouts. What do you think? Sustainable, unsustainable? What do you think of Mr. Mauer's start?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be quite this sustainable. I don't think he's going to finish with an on-base percentage that high. But I do think so far there's been some positive signs. Like you said, the big thing is just the strikeout rate and the walk rate. I think those are kind of stats that tend to normalize a little bit earlier than other stats. So I think that, the fact that he's seeing the ball so well, I don't see a situation where all of a sudden now he's going to start striking out a bunch more and drop in terms of walks. I think more than anything, I think he's just probably is healthier than he's been the last few years. His concussion symptoms have gone down over time. It's hard to say, if he's going to fully keep it up, but I do think kind of looking at a lot of the peripheral stats, it's not like he's, doing anything too far over his head. His line drive rate's a little bit higher than his normal average, but I'm sure that'll come down. That'll probably bring down the average and on base a little bit. But in terms of the walks and strikeouts, that's kind of the best sign so far, especially the strikeouts, because that's something the last 2 years really kind of jumped up on him. I think that was such an elite hitter for such a long time, partly because he didn't strike out very much. He put the ball in play a ton, hit for a high average. I think the previous two seasons, the strikeout rates went up pretty dramatically. I mean, for him to kind of get back down to a low normal, which is kind of him before the concussion, I think is definitely a good sign for him that he can carry forward.
Yeah, the walks to strikeout thing is real. There's no doubt he's an elite hitter, a smart hitter. We know he's not going to hit for the power he did in his MVP year, but certainly that plate discipline when that's in full force, this guy is a force. We spoke going into spring training about his struggles in day games versus night games. It's something he had spoken about, and the numbers certainly bore that out. As far as solution to that, it was thrown out, well, he could wear sunglasses in day games, and you kind of shrug and say, okay, not sure how much of a difference that's going to make. But it turns out he does have some help from glasses of a different sort. I've seen the reports, I believe the St. Paul Pioneer Press had the first report about his goggles that he's been wearing as a training device, basically kind of basically forces you to keep your eye on the ball. Otherwise, the strobe light effect takes in on these goggles. Kind of an interesting story, right? I mean, it's a unique training method. I haven't heard much about this with other players, but it seems to be working for Joe.
Yeah, definitely. It is definitely interesting. I've never really heard of that before either. I want to say even Nike even discontinued the glasses that they make that they're using right now. But for Joe, it appears to be working, obviously. It kind of helps him track the ball and not move his head. At the same time, though, guys like Eddie Rosario has been using it, and he's been having, a pretty bad start to the season, I guess you could say, compared to last year. So it's hard to say how much of it really is what's helping Joe, considering other players are trying it out, so really no help, to be honest, so far. But for Joe, though, I think it's a good tracking thing for him because it allows him to kind of keep that head still, track the ball better, see the ball better, and he knows if he moves too early, the strobe lights are going to affect you. So I think it's a good tool for him, it seems like. It's working. You just kind of use it only like during, you're only using it when they're doing like soft toss, that kind of stuff. It's not like they're doing that during actual real hitting. But I think it's just a way to keep your mechanics in line, especially kind of moving your head. And I think the big thing we talked about with Joe was, just seeing the ball. I think the previous years, we've talked about the whole sunglass deal, having trouble with the lights and the glare during day games. And it just seemed like the kind of his big skill was always how well he could track the ball. In the last few years, that wasn't the case. And I think this year, we're seeing that. And I think these glasses probably do have a little bit of help in terms of helping him kind of keep his mechanics and his head straight and kind of look for the ball and things like that. Because I think that's the big thing we've seen so far, just better plate discipline and better back control. And I'm sure these glasses probably, he said they definitely helped him a little bit here, and we'll kind of see how much other guys use them going forward. It's definitely an interesting thing to do there to kind of get ready for the games.
Well, you're right. Nike did discontinue them. I meant to bring those bad boys back. It just keeps up.
Exactly.
So, Mauer, high-profile athlete, of course. I could probably use these things on the golf course, you know, keeping your head down. But, you know, as uplifting as Mauer's start is, that's how concerning Miguel Sano's start is, I mean, especially defensively. It's kind of the concerns we had about him making that transition to right field. You know, he had a -4 defensive run saved here in the early going, so it seems those concerns were justified.
Yeah, so far it's been tough for him in the outfield. He's had some rough ones out there, especially missed a sinking liner in a game last week that kind of led to 3 runs and an eventual loss that, you know, I think could have been prevented if he just caught the fly ball that I think most guys would have caught. It was a sinking liner and hit off his glove. His arm has been fine out there. It's just all about kind of, you know, reading the ball off the bat correctly and footwork. Things that we were kind of worried about in spring have started kind of manifest himself here so far in the early going. Obviously, it's still so early that he could obviously get better as it goes along, but those growing pains are real. We'll kind of see what they want to do going forward. I think right now, with Plouffe out, they did get Sano at third base for one game, but it sounds like they don't want to do that permanently just because he hasn't really had that many reps there at third base in recent years, even just because he had the Tommy John in 2014. He's only played like 70 games at third going back to 2013. So a lot of fans obviously want Sano to go to third base now while Plouffe's out. This way they can have more of an athletic outfield. They can have an outfield of, you know, Buxton, Rosario, and even Danny Santana. I think he's expected to get activated from the DL. But I think the Twins would rather even just put Danny Santana at third. I think truthfully they just think those guys are Eduardo Nunez are just better defensive third baseman than Sano right now. And I think part of it too, they want to get as many reps as they can in the outfield for Sano, because this could be a permanent move. They don't know for sure, but you know, Plouffe's still on a contract for next year, so you got to figure that barring an unlikely trade, he'll probably be back at third base. They have obviously Park and Mauer on a contract for several years, so for Sano, the only way for him to really play almost is in right field. But so far, defensively, it really hasn't worked out the way they were hoping, but at the same time, it's not too unexpected just because the struggles he had in spring training and the fact that it's just a totally new position for him. He's such a big guy. He's an athletic guy, but he's still 270 pounds out there, which is just rare to see. And I think that with time, he could become an okay outfielder out there, but so far, he's definitely had his fair share of struggles.
Jeffrey is in Anaheim. I am in Cleveland. We're going to meet somewhere in the middle and talk about this club from Kansas City. Jeffrey, the Royals keep chugging along and winning series, and now they're a little more whole. As far as the roster is concerned, Jerod Dyson rejoined the club since we last spoke, and he's wasted no time making an impact offensively, 7 for his first 19. Nice to see him back and doing things. Yeah, it's really it gives the bottom of the order a lot of life with his athleticism and his speed, and we just kind of noticed that right away. And he's been getting on base and creating a little havoc on the bases, so I'm sure Ned and his staff are very glad to have him back, and they really want to give him an opportunity, as they said during the offseason, to give him 400 or 500 at bats and see what kind of guy they have, if he can be an everyday player. And so I think it's going to be a real soft platoon, between very loose platoon between him and Paulo Orlando, although Paulo was on the All-Star ballot, interestingly enough. But so we'll probably just see a lot of Dyson.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously a guy who can impact the game in a lot of ways. So you mentioned Ned. Ned had voiced some faith in Chris Young after his slow start to the season, and I'm sure they were happy to see him rebound. 10 strikeouts in 6 innings against the Orioles. Not the kind of strikeout totals you necessarily expect from Chris Young, although he did show some strikeout stuff on the postseason stage last year. So that was a big start for him, given the way things had started off.
Yeah, it's really kind of, the fan base was kind of down on him, but, you look at the pitchers he was facing, Noah Syndergaard and Sonny Gray, and then he had to go into Houston and pitch in the Astros opener, and that's not a great ballpark for a fly ball pitcher. But actually the first game he pitched against Syndergaard was actually pretty good. He only gave up 2 runs in 5 innings, and but, of course, the fan base was kind of freaking out about him, and that stuck with him, and he bounced back and had a terrific outing against the Orioles. Every once in a while, he'll get that slider going and getting guys to chase the fastball out of the zone, and you'll see some pretty impressive strikeout totals from him. So it's not totally unusual to see that, but
just a really great bounce back outing for him, and should the strength of the staff kind of continues to amaze me.
Yeah, Yordano Ventura has been a big part of that. The Royals have won 15 of Ventura's last 17 regular season starts, or games he has started, I should say. He's got a 2.35 ERA through four starts. We knew this was a linchpin kind of guy for the Royals pitching staff, for the Royals in general, and he certainly delivered here early on.
Yeah, and he just, you know, was at times overpowering yesterday. I think he retired 19 of the last 21 guys he's faced, and what he does the best, I think, and why he has that amazing win total is he keeps the Royals in games. Even when he doesn't really have his great stuff, you know, even if he's laboring a little bit, he'll get through five innings and maybe give up two runs or maybe three, and they're still in the game. And with the Royals' offense and their belief that they can come back, and then with their bullpen, it's really no shock with those numbers. So they're just asking their staff, hey, just keep us in the game for five or six innings, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, that's a formula that's worked for them pretty well in the recent past. You mentioned the bullpen. You wrote a bit about this. Luke Hochaver's role has evolved basically to the role of fireman, putting out fires, other people's fires that they start. He comes in and kind of cleans up the mess. He's been really good at that here early on.
Yeah, he has. He's only I think he's only allowed one inherited base runner to score, and I think he at one point he was leading the majors in facing the most inherited runners, and it's a situation they don't really fall into a whole lot. The normal formula is, you know, everybody comes in for a clean inning, but every once in a while, early in the season here, we've had some jams for the Royals in late in innings, and Luke's come in and just done a phenomenal job, and I'd kind of expected this would happen with him. You know, I thought Luke was pretty good last year, but now his second full season coming back from TJ surgery, and he just looks like his command is there. He's sharp. He's, you know, hitting 95, 96 on the gun, and just doing a terrific job.
That's kind of when they signed him to the multi-year deal coming off TJ, that was kind of the thought, right? I mean, the first year would have some bumps along the way, as is typical with post-Tommy John. The second year really settle in.
Yeah, and I think they're hoping for the same thing to happen with Chris Medlin this year. And he had a really good start in Oakland, a not so good start a couple days ago. So, but I think they're hoping that he'll have the same kind of resurgence that Luke did.
Absolutely. Salvador Perez has had a resurgence offensively after a real strong start. 263 batting average and 295 on base percentage, but he's driving the ball. Nine extra base hits already, including four home runs. What's gotten into Sal?
I don't know. I think he's just, you know, all these young guys have all kind of hit their stride at different times of their career. You know, we saw Moose have his breakout year last year, and Haas certainly to a degree. And I kind of thought during the offseason that maybe Sal would be that guy this year who maybe shows a little bit more patience at the plate, though that's really not been the case. But he could be a guy I thought that you know, could reach the 25 homer mark. He's just had a terrific homestand, three big home runs, and you know, when he's a big guy, and when he barrels it, it goes a long way, even at Kauffman Stadium. But I expect a big year from him.
JB, geez, a lot of comings and goings right now. Michael Brantley rejoining the club in Minnesota this week. Carlos Carrasco with a hamstring injury. You had a nice relaxing Sunday at the ballpark, Comerica Park on Sunday, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, day in the life, you go to the park and you think, you know, hey, I don't really know if I'm going to have much to write about today. So we went over and we grabbed Omar Vizquel so he could, you know, just kind of gush about what he's seen from Francisco Lindor and, you know, kind of file that story just so we'd have something on the site. And next thing you know, it's just bang, 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 a bunch of things piling on top of each other. Was quite a day and, you know, obviously kind of a mix of news, you know, the pending activation of Michael Brantley coming soon and Carlos Carrasco going down with the injury, you know, a lot of implications up and down the roster with both of these moves. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out over the next couple weeks, maybe a couple months.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to make it abundantly clear to the listening audience, we are recording this at 1:51 p.m. Eastern time on Monday. So as of this moment, we don't know if Michael Brantley is activated in the lineup. We don't know how long Carlos Carrasco is out. But on both fronts, we can take a decent guess in that you know, Brantley is certainly
much sooner than later, and Carrasco was much later than sooner, because that hamstring injury did not look particularly good. But let's start with Brantley, JB. Obviously, this has enormous implications on the lineup. Jose Ramirez, in particular, will be affected by this. He's, of course, played very well for the Indians here early on, but his role will change as a result of Dr. Smooth's return. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think a really interesting development over the last few days has been the emergence of Carlos Santana, leadoff hitter, and that experiment has gone pretty well so far. You know, I think it reminded me of a few years ago before Terry Francona when Shin-Soo Chu was really struggling and Manny Acta put him in the leadoff spot and really kind of threw us all when he did that. And then Chu got real hot and all of a sudden everyone looked at him as a leadoff hitter. Santana doesn't really fit that prototypical mold, but I think he's done really well, and obviously the on-base ability and seeing pitches makes a lot of sense. So it'll be interesting now, because last year the Kipnis 1, Lindor 2, Brantley 3 was a very effective combination. So it'll be interesting to see if Francona was just doing a short-lived experiment knowing Brantley was coming back, and then Carlos Santana will go back to the middle of the lineup behind Mike Napoli. You know, one thing Francona has made clear throughout the Santana experiment is that he loves the idea, but he still worries about the run production by taking really one of the Indians' most effective power bats out of the middle. So that'll be interesting to see how he handles the structure of the lineup when Brantley comes back. And then, yeah, Jose Ramirez has proved to be a very versatile and valuable weapon for the Indians in the early going, especially as some other guys have been slow out of the gate. You know, they've run him out to left field, which is obviously Brantley's position. He got some reps in center field during spring training, but Francona doesn't really view that as a regular option. That would just sort of be, hey, it's good to know Rose can go out there in a pinch if the Indians need it. And then obviously he's played third base, but that's where they have Juan Uribe. So, you know, it's an interesting situation because they want to keep Jose Ramirez involved as much as possible. So you'll see him bounce around, you know, Lindor, Kipnis, if they need a day off, he can go up the middle and play there as well. So, you know, he's kind of been a spark plug early. That helmet keeps flying off, and that means good things are happening, and, you know, they want to keep seeing that happening. So, but obviously having Brantley back is going to be huge and a huge lift. And I think what's very important right now is the fact that the Indians could be getting Brantley back while they have a winning record in April. So I think that's they've done an excellent job of sort of keeping their heads above water and then some in his absence.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the big picture hope was just mere survival without Brantley. And so that is a huge boost, and that's offset in some measure by the Carlos Carrasco news, which, again, we don't know the exact extent of it. But, man, what a bummer to see him come off the field like that. And obviously a key cog in the rotation. And, and it's a good thing it's not arm or shoulder related, of course, but it's still a pretty serious issue.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Carlos Carrasco is a big guy. And when he went down as quick as he did, and when he tries to stand up and then immediately drops down to his knees, I mean, you knew this wasn't a tweak. You know, this wasn't just, you know, a cramp that flared up. So that's pretty bad. And, you know, I think it's disappointing just in the you know, the greatness of the game aspect. You know, this guy's a really big breakout candidate. A lot of people pegged him to be a Cy Young contender, was really one of the better starters for the Indians over the last 2 years. So losing him for any amount of time, whether it's 2 weeks on the DL or whether it's 2 months on the DL, is a pretty devastating blow. I think what helps in the immediacy is that there's a few off days coming up. So Cleveland could exist with a four-man rotation until May 7th. So they have a little bit of a cushion there just in terms of aligning their staff. And also they entered the season with an extra arm in the bullpen, and that extra arm was Trevor Bauer. So there's this natural ability to have a guy transition into the rotation if they need it. So in terms of depth and in terms of timing, it's not the – you don't want to say it's not the worst because it's a horrible development for the Indians. But there are some factors that could help ease sort of the burden of losing him in the immediate picture.
Yep, that's hope. That is the hope. And I was one of those people who pegged Carrasco as my Cy Young pick, so I'll take the heat for this. This is a clear case of the Castro curse. Not to be confused
with the ML Bastion jinx. But
right.
You mentioned in happier times, Omar Vizquel talking about Francisco Lindor.
Yeah.
Of course, that's an opinion that matters, coming from an 11-time Gold Glove winner. What do you have to say about old Frankie?
Yeah, well, I mean, Omar was very political about it. He made sure he mentioned Iglesias and Correa and Alcides Escobar and a few other shortstops. But basically, it's that idea that a lot of us have written about and talked about, this emergence of this new, younger crop of shortstops coming up, and just how much fun it is to see them breaking into the big leagues, having success, and how much fun it's going to be seeing them over the next decade, you know, how this all plays out. And, you know, we asked if Lindor reminds himself at all of himself. And, you know, he kind of shied away from that, but he said, you know, he really loves the creativity that he's seen from Francisco at shortstop. And, you know, when in talking to Lindor, Lindor believes that creativity is probably the most important attribute for a shortstop, because there are plays like when Miguel Cabrera hits a 107-mile-an-hour one-hopper that knocks you over into the outfield grass. You got to be a little creative in figuring out how you're going to get that out for space. And obviously Omar got to watch Lindor pull that play off over the weekend in Detroit. So, you know, he got some highlight reel plays right in front of him. And obviously when you're an 11-time Gold Glove Award winner and a huge fan favorite of the Indians, you know, his opinion carries a lot of weight. So it was pretty cool to kind of hear some of his comments about Lindor. And you can read all about it on Indians.com.